It is Saturday, August 22nd, 2015. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio, 88.9 and KUSP.org. And ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch, and with me in the studio is Brian Young, a CG artist, iOS developer, and lifelong tinkerer. Hey, Brian.
Good morning, Bonnie.
Also, Lyle Troxell, software engineer, face painter, and family man.
Howdy.
Hi. And Miles Elam, political junkie and software engineer. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
Lots to talk about today. We're going to be having some news updates, some good discussion, and let's start off with a very intriguing development to me. I've been intrigued by 3D printing in general, Miles, but now we can do it with glass. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes, MIT has now created a 3D printing, a 3D printer that uses glass as a medium, as opposed to, for example, plastics.
Too awesome!
What the heck? How does it work?
Well, you know, they just heat it up to 1,900 degrees Fahrenheit, and they have a alumina zircon silica nozzle that won't melt under those
temperatures. As you do.
Like one has.
What you say? What was that called again? Aluminum.
Alumina zircon silica.
And are all of those, you know, planet metals and stuff from Earth, or some of those from outer space?
Yeah, aluminum zircon silicon.
Yeah.
As an alloy.
Okay.
And that's the nozzle that actually has to handle the high heat and not get clogged, I'm assuming.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't just sort of like take out the plastic spool and put in a glass spool into your same machine.
You could, but you wouldn't have a good time.
Yeah, no.
Well,
ow.
Well, here's the thing about glass, though. It you know, has the properties of a liquid and continually, slowly, ever so slowly deforming its shape. So they've got to be able to print this and then cool it down quick enough that it pretty much holds that shape, right?
Unless you have some type of mold waiting for it to bound the outer sides.
Of course, you have to make the mold. It becomes less a printer if you have like a whole process in place.
Well, is this printer an additive or a subtractive process?
It's an additive.
It's just like one of the ones you've got at home, right, Bonnie? Don't you have a 3D printer?
Yeah,
we do. A little goopy one?
Yeah. I haven't actually seen it in action.
The way I've described 3D printers is like a hot glue gun, computer controlled. So it slowly builds up a layer over layer over layer.
Yeah, so you do end up with a ridge structure. At least that's the example that's given here on the screen. You'll see up on our website.
The first bound glass, the second, don't actually connect really well. They just kind of connect. So you can tell that it was squeezed out.
You can see the layers.
Yeah.
Like playing with Play-Doh.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like a record player. Like, if you follow one edge going all around, it keeps going up and 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 up. But it's still, there are many plastic 3D printers that do exactly the same thing. Mm. So this is nothing new, and this is a first gen. So
okay, so new material, not a new method, but a new material.
Yes.
And new method and in as much as it's required for the new material.
Yeah, and can be optically transparent, you know, because it's glass.
So can they
actually keep all the bubbles out of it and keep it clear?
It doesn't look like it has bubbles in it at all. Yeah, it's pretty clear.
And what we're looking at is a story from MIT Press, which we'll link to on geekspeak.org, so you can check this out for yourself and have your own questions answered about, but how? Okay, so that's an exciting development. I hear there is another company that is doing some interesting development that requires some help, Brian.
Yes, they do require help. Remember, I think it was back in 2004, Google started their recruiting with a billboard that they put a mysterious little billboard up that only the geekiest among us would start trying to decipher. And if you understood the math, you would end up on a website that had a further question. And that eventually led to a recruiting site where you could then sign up for an interview in some way, only if you had the cred to figure this out.
So it's like using the tricks and puzzles of alternate reality games as a recruiting tool.
Yeah, Google made a name for themselves by using this. Well, another company company in Tel Aviv is trying something similar. They're putting up posters and billboards in Klingon because they believe
like
that
you do.
That there's such a shortage in good tech people, especially in the hot startup market of Tel Aviv.
They're looking for the real geeks.
If you know Klingon, you've got what it takes
to
come on in, interview with them, and see if you can get a job. And this isn't only for software engineers. They're also looking for salespeople and some other positions through the same mechanism.
So it is so too useful, Mom.
Johnny, how do you get a job, Klingon?
So this company is called Zoos. They are trying to sort of set up a arbitrage system for those people who use credit cards, credit card processing.
You said an arbitrage system? Arbitrage.
Basically,
arbitrage.
You hire a company to do your credit card processing, and they will charge you a certain fee, but those fees kind of float among the different different companies you can use for this, and especially if you start taking in currency fluctuations. So they're setting up an automated system to choose the best price for you at that moment.
Well, it's like Priceline for that thing.
For credit card
so
fees.
This is a very complex system that they want some help building.
So they want Klingon speakers to
exactly.
help.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Wow.
There'll be a lot of roaring and triumph.
Do any of the geeks here speak Klingon?
You know, our one Klingon speaker, I think, is out at the moment.
Yeah, I think Ben speaks Klingon.
He's recovering from world travel.
Yeah. Seems like an odd way to do it, if you're going to...
I don't know. If you're heavily seeped in geek culture, are you good at computer engineering?
I think there's a higher percentage of computer engineers that know Klingon than average people that know Klingon. But
it
doesn't mean it's the best way to target a marketing strategy.
It seems to be more of
but then again, it covers a lot of press. We're talking about it. Maybe that's the reason. You know, like all of a sudden, everybody's talking about this company that does arbitrage for credit card companies.
Since none of us are Klingon speakers, this may be sort of a hypothetical question, but is the sort of geek who enjoys speaking and knowing Klingon the sort of geek who wants to work for a company like that? Is it the kind of work that Klingon geeks want to do?
In Klingon, arbitrage means.
No. Or is it the equivalent of saying, you people should help us?
Well, there's a lot to be said for making a team that works well together
being more
important than somebody who has just that high-level skill that you're really looking for.
Okay, so a Klingon, by the way.
Oh, we have to explain
from the
this?
Star Trek universe. Worf is a Klingon. He's the most famous of the Klingons.
Rawr.
Yes.
Really, you need to explain who a Klingon is.
Hey, some people don't know. Just because you're a geek.
Next Generation had higher ratings than Monday Night Football.
Really?
Seriously?
Yes. No kidding.
Some of our listeners the show was not on when they were alive. So some people might need to know.
We could be talking to
Hey, generation. Did you not know what a Klingon was until I specified? Please do let us know. We're on Twitter. Of course, you don't know what Twitter is, so darn.
The 13-year-old in my house is schooling me on the Star Trek universe. So
right on.
Yeah, the geekery is alive and well for the
More
next
popular
generation.
Than Monday Night Football?
Yes.
That excites me.
I mean, during at the end of the Borg, when they're meeting the Borg. And
The Borg
season
is
two,
a,
season three.
Is a race of aliens. Sorry. We can do this all day.
Really?
Extra explainers. We need a footnoted geek speak. Brian, you know, we've been talking a lot on this show about the predictability of passwords, and please get beyond 1234 or password.
Monkey 123.
Yeah, monkey 123. It's no good. And apparently that's gotten extra dimensional somehow.
Well, yes, because people are really bad at making random patterns. Our minds work pretty consistently.
We're pattern seekers.
So in the Android world, somebody can set up a instead of a password to unlock.
And
their
by
phone.
The Android world, we mean the phone Android, not the world of androids that will one day take over the earth.
Like data.
Data is an Android.
Yeah, so you actually bought the Borg in episodes.
Sorry. Technically is dead, but whatever.
Okay. But has an off button that he doesn't tell everyone about.
So if you have an Android phone, you may have the option to set up a swipe pattern to unlock your phone instead of a normal password or number key pin password.
Okay, now I've seen that, but I think it was on a Windows machine where you could touch different parts of a picture and use that as a password, but this is like a new like a pad of
It's a number pad. It's a 3x3 grid of numbers and
dots. It's just dots.
I'm sorry, of dots. You can think of it as a telephone keypad, but it's just dots.
Okay.
But the important part is you place your thumb, your finger on one of those dots, and you swipe in a pattern that only you know, so only you can unlock the phone.
Okay.
The problem is that the people tend to choose predictable patterns. And a researcher doing a graduate thesis in Norwegian University of Science and Technology started to analyze this. And he found that there was enough of a predictable pattern that people just are not making safe swipe patterns for their unlocking.
So like we all want to do the same thing?
Once again, we are not unique snowflakes.
No, we're not unique snowflakes.
And it's, this story is so common because, of course, for passwords and such, this happens as well. People use the same passwords over and over again, even though they think they're unique. Monkey is a great example of that. A lot of people use the word monkey because they think of a weird thing, and then they use that as their password. Not unique at all. So now, even with moving your finger across a screen,
we do that the
not
same.
Unique.
So if you approach a password like, oh, nobody will ever guess this, you're coming at it from the wrong point of view. Because the way...
You just guessed it, pal.
Well, the way...
to be able to use it.
The way people hack passwords is not, nobody can ever guess this thing. They look for patterns that are predictable. Like, maybe... in this case, 77% of the people will start in one of the four corners. So because of that, a hacker can start to limit the possibilities from what could be, in this case, 389,000 possible combinations down to something much more hackable. So in this case, if you only choose five different positions for your swipe, for your they call them nodes, five different nodes that you link together with your swipes, that reduces it down to 9,000 combinations. And that's before you start considering that if you if most people start in the corner, you can reduce that to fewer combinations. And if you choose to make the shape of a letter with your swipes, like maybe the letter A, nobody will ever guess that.
Yeah.
You're now limiting the possibilities to something much fewer that a hacker can make a quick guesses at.
So what do we do? Because the geek advice for alphanumeric passwords is to make something super long string, maybe an entire sentence, or maybe a randomizer thing that you then plug into some sort of a LastPass or something and have it generate for you so that you have no idea. But you can't do that with the swipey pattern.
Well, I'm sure somebody could come up with a auto generator that would be true.
I was just looking for one. I couldn't find one.
Well, an auto generator of, but then you have to be able to perform it and remember to perform it.
Yeah, incidentally, this is why fingerprints scanners exist now for cell phones, is because no matter the solution you do, if you're limiting it by what human beings can remember and stuff like that, it ends up being
it's
compromised.
Well, are you just being an Apple head there? I mean, how many phones use
Apple's not the only one that does it, but I mean, they're the only ones who do it correctly because they bought the company that did it the best, which is...
Well, there's issues with fingerprint readers because people are concerned about their biometric data, which they can't change their fingerprints, getting out of their control, getting lost.
And there's been examples of bad implementations on Android environments with the swipers that do leak that information, unfortunately.
So it's really important that that's implemented well and truly secure. But the problem isn't necessarily making something that a human can or can't remember. That is a problem because you don't want to have something that has too few possibilities to it. But the big problem is humans don't generate random noise. We just can't think randomly.
Yeah.
In fact, if you ask a human to tell you if a sequence of numbers is random or not, they will see that it's random when it really isn't. It's there's far more predictability to it than there is. So what you need to do is have some way to generate this that truly uses random entropy.
So what if there were geek advice about whether or not to use finger swiping, what's your initial sense, guys?
One thought would be to read this article, see what's actually common, and don't do that. But then, of course, if someone knows that you did that, then they've just removed a whole bunch of possibilities.
Yeah. Except so none random of them listens to the show, which means that it's a good case for you to do that, to separate out the weed from the chaff. You are no longer the low-hanging fruit.
The other
just by listening to our show.
True.
Is this the Iocane powder discussion?
Yeah. So don't start in a corner. Don't go from top left to, or don't go from left to right and from top to down. Do the opposite direction.
Okay.
Don't make patterns that are letters or numbers.
But again, all of these things won't work over time. Like, it's better to actually get a random generator. The other thing is, make sure your lock screen, after four attempts, fails and sets you back to a complicated password that you've maybe written down and put in your desk drawer. That's probably better than
another. What about going something. Long, Brian? You mentioned something about so you just have, do five swipes.
You can have up to 9 different transitions nodes. So longer is always better.
Except that's harder for the bind, and it's slower, and therefore you might not use it as much.
Right. So there's the practical considerations.
Yeah.
Probably the best thing for phones these days is a fingerprint reader that's well implemented.
Okay, Appleheads.
Well, no. There are some Android implementations that have gotten respect. There. Long pregnant pause.
Yeah.
So it would be nice also if they changed the swipe pattern to instead be a 3x3 grid to be a 5x5. That increases the pool that you're working from tremendously.
Okay.
Right.
So that's how Android could help, is A, by developing a good fingerprint scanner thing, or B, creating at least a larger grid for people to work on.
I personally don't think this is a major problem, because the swipe is not actually the password in your phone. It is a shortcut to get into your phone, just like the keypad is not actually your password. It's a shortcut to get, or the, sorry, the thumb
print. Oh, I see. Yeah.
So in my mind, what it is it's so that your, you know, grandmother doesn't pick up your phone and do something, or somebody, your phone, your friends doesn't mess with your stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The actual hacking of it is problematic if that was the only mechanism, but I think that Android's implemented in such a way that with a certain amount of fail attempts, it bypasses it completely.
It depends on the vendor. It depends on how much they've hacked.
But I think the big takeaway from this, and this is said by another podcast we listened to, if you're trying to be clever with your passwords, you're not going to be clever enough. There is no cleverness now that hackers can't get around and use to their advantage.
We are just, after all, ugly bags of mostly water. We can't do everything. You're listening to Geek Speak here on KUSP. We'll be right back. The music of Chinese composer Huang Ro knows no bounds. It weaves the ancient folk music and instruments he heard as a child with Western classical avant-garde and rock into something entirely new. Huang Ro, who was featured at this year's Cabrillo Festival of Contemporary Music, joins host Robert Polly to talk about his life and career and share some tunes and sing some of his favorite Chinese folk songs. Now, when is that going to happen? It's going to happen Sunday at noon on the 7th Avenue Project, a highly recommended show by me, which you can hear every week on KUSP. You can find him at 7thAvenueProject.com, or you can listen from the talk section of KUSP.org if you're not tuning in live Sundays at noon. Right now, you're listening to Geek Speak on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch, and with me is Brian Young, Miles Elam, and Lyle Troxell. You can visit our website, geekspeak.org, to learn more about what we're talking about today and see interesting things we call web extras. And Brian, you have a web extra today for us, don't you?
Oh, yeah. So I thought this was so cool. You know, in computer science, there are all sorts of algorithms that people use for solving different problems. And somebody has made a website that animates a whole plethora of different sorting algorithms.
Mm.
So we all do this in our own lives. We have ways, like if we're sorting out money, we have different patterns that we use to that we think are going to be faster to sort coins or anything else. If you have one of those children's posts that have different shapes. What is it called? I'm trying to remember. There's a name for this toy where you stack up the different rings.
Well, we can imagine.
Yeah.
So
this site,
or those guys who do with the cups really fast.
Yeah, this site that you can see the link from our website animates all these different sorting algorithms from different starting states, whether it's completely random or whether you're just sorting something that was already backwards. And by hitting the play button and seeing how it animates, you can see the efficiencies or inefficiencies in different sorting algorithms. And even if you're not a computer scientist at all, it's fascinating to watch this thing play out and see what works in different situations. I just get mesmerized by taking a look at it.
Interesting. And so, yeah, what information do you glean when you watch it?
Well, if I'm going to start attacking a problem, this is the kind of thing that instead of mathematically thinking about it, I can quickly visually look at it and start getting a sense of different solutions to the problem before I even sit down and try to analyze it in a deeper way. I can approach it from an intuitive way at first.
Yeah, okay. This is reminding me of something. Didn't we cover this before? It was a different...
A different sorting algorithm site.
Yeah,
we actually talked about this on the November 26, 2011 episode of Geek Speak.
Oh.
We talked about another sorting algorithm. Though I think that site was run on... the actual applets with Java applets or Flash applets.
Oh,
so
okay.
This one's cool because there are animated GIFs, which all browsers use without a plugin.
So. Okay, great. So we no longer have, because some people are not down with Flash anymore. We talked about that too.
Definitely true. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, well, so we'll have to check that out. And you can see that at geekspeak.org, of course, of course. Now, I wanted to talk about, you know, during this show, usually during this time, we kind of get a little deeper into the more sort of philosophical discussion-y aspects of Geeklandia. And, Brian, you've had something that you've been wanting to bring up for a couple weeks now about just what is going on. Why aren't there more women in tech? Why don't they just get in the pipeline and then everything will be fine?
Okay, so I'm going to back up a little bit here because I got thinking about what are some common traits among geeks? What are some common things that we kind of see among the different people, different software engineers, tech people that we know? And what traits would you say?
Obsessive.
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 I was talking to Lyle about
Speaking
this.
On.
The first thing, he said was a pedant, which made me laugh. I think one of the things that really defines a lot of the people I know in this space are that they want to be self improving. They really find things that they want things to be fact based. They want there to be a right answer.
The self improving is an interesting one because there's side effects to that. So if you're constantly looking at how you can improve what you do, like even turning on and off a light switch in a room, that's something that geeks actually kind of think about more than they probably should, about these little tiny steps and making them more efficient and better. And improving somebody else's pattern of doing things like that seems like an obvious thing to suggest. So that's where the pedantry comes from, right? This idea that, well, you know, if you close the door before you put your bag down, then you would have less torque on your body as you spun around. Like, you know, things like that, that it doesn't matter, except that it feels like to a geek that it's a small improvement, so you should mention it and share that idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because the pool of geeks has consisted of a lot of folks with that personality trait, now that personality trait is associated with geekdom in general.
It's common in geekdom, and it's more familiar, I would say. But no, I think that actually some of that, for like software engineers, those patterns of thought actually follow well with doing software engineering.
They help make the work go well.
I should say software engineering application, you know, code is created by people that think that way. Mm-hmm. And therefore thinking that way is helpful in using the language. Like they all kind of feed, you know, an ecosystem feeds itself in a lot of ways. And so I don't think it's clear what. You don't think a programming language is defined by a certain type of mind and therefore it's easier for that type of mind to use?
No.
Why not?
Yeah, what was the reservation there?
Because I think of languages like Perl. Perl was written by a linguist.
Mm-hmm.
And the style of code that you do with that lends itself to a different type of program.
So you're supporting what I'm saying?
No, but I mean, like, it's different than, say, someone who writes in Haskell. Like,
yeah, that's my whole point.
Lyle's point is that the author of the language influences who will best use it because somebody who thinks like that author will more likely use the language better.
And therefore, if you have a history of people making languages that have those traits, you'll see those traits in the languages. That's more than likely. I'm not saying that's a definite. I've never even thought about that idea. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that definitely that could exist.
So my point is that the tech space is filled with people that are thinking this way. Mm-hmm. And I know I do. My wife and I get in discussions all the time where I'm being too hard on her and she thinks I'm criticizing her. And I'm not criticizing you. I just thought we wanted to be better at what we do. Mm-hmm. And so this got me thinking. And the reason why I'm talking about this now is there is a long-running thread now in the tech community about women in tech, women in software engineering roles, women in tech in general, and how there's this huge discrepancy between the number of women that are going into school and the number of women that are staying in their careers.
Right.
And it's one thing to get
them in the pipeline, and it's another for it to be sticky enough that they want to stay.
Yeah. And the only way this is going to change is when the whole community recognizes it and is actually conscious of it and introspective enough to see their part in it. And the article that got me thinking about that specifically is written by Rachel Thomas on Medium. And the title of the article says it all. If you think women in tech is just a pipeline problem, then you're not paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes through citing study after study after study about different things supporting her case that I think everybody should read. But the reason why I'm talking about geek culture is because we pride ourselves on this self-improvement, on fact-based and data-based improvement and the thinking through problems with data. And here is data that you need to look at and really consider your part in everyday life in the tech community and how it affects those around you, specifically women. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to go through a couple of
now,
these things real quick.
I want to just get the I've got a little lady filter monitor here going. I'm just hoping the other shoe that will not drop is, you know, we are self-critical and continually learning and merit-based and fact-based and data-based and also competitive. And to let the ladies in, we need to not be like that so much.
Are you talking about the competitiveness?
I'm talking about the competitiveness. I'm talking about making a distinction between fact-based and women or data-based and women or merit-based and women. Some women who are listening to this conversation right now might be thinking, hold on, where are they going with this? When geeks are this way and we're trying to make way for women, is the argument that we should be less merit-based or less fact-based or less data-based?
Oh, you mean in our career? No, that's not what I'm saying at all.
Okay, good. Yeah, so tell me more about
this. This is something, if I may, with regard to geekdom, as it stands right now, where you have a whole lot of people who do work with logic on a regular basis. They do work with this schematizing of information, things like that. Mm-hmm. And there is a thought process of, I have learned to think logically, therefore I think logically about all decisions.
Yes.
Including social interactions.
Right. Things that may not even be my area, because I can just apply logic to this other area and come up with the right solution intuitively.
Yeah. Linus Pauling, great physicist, maybe not so good on vitamin C stuff.
Right, which reminds me, some of what goes on today reminds me very much of psychology from the 50s and 60s, where it was extremely racist, it mm-hmm. was extremely sexist, mm-hmm. it was extremely biased, and they were coming from a point of view that they thought was the scientific method. They were coming from the point of view they honestly believed that this is the reality. This is just the objective truth. This is where the data led
okay.
us.
Okay, so right. it can be a dangerous sort of unexamined aspect.
Right, and so if you start thinking of it in terms of we need to compromise our meritocracy to let women in, mm-hmm. that I worry about that notion of, we need to lower our standards, or we need to do these things. Well, because it never talks about, okay, before a certain date, mm-hmm. before, say, 15 years ago, mm-hmm. it was nothing but, you know, men.
But that's not even accurate.
Well, but I mean talking about in the right, but I mean, like, in terms of computer science, in terms of the discipline, in terms of the job market, it was heavily based.
There we go.
And you have this notion of, if you look at the population, mm-hmm. and then you say, really, do you think in a meritocracy where whoever's the smartest or the most capable, mm-hmm. that somehow all of these men, and men not Black and Latino,
right,
suddenly filter to the top and nothing is wrong?
Mm-hmm.
That's when you have to worry. It's that thing of, if Hollywood were meritocracy, which most people don't think it is, but if you were thinking of, like, if Hollywood were meritocracy, then where are all the ugly people?
Right, right?
All the ugly people who
we got,
are
what,
great
Ernest
method
Borgnine
actors.
And that's it.
Well, and especially
Vincent
of women.
Vincent Schiavelli, and that's it.
Well, and especially of women.
Right.
Like, where are the ugly women who are amazing actresses?
Right.
But suddenly are not top tier mm-hmm. movie stars.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, but here there are. I mean, we're just a stone's throw from Silicon Valley, but the tech community is all across the world.
Right.
You're in your company. You're part of the group. You're a manager, or you're a part of a hiring group, and you have to somehow judge who's the best person for this job. People need to be introspective enough to realize that there is traits out there that are highly valuable that they need to consider outside of their own personal understanding. In other words, I find most guys to be competitive. I find most people in tech to be competitive, and competition's good, but there are ways of working that are collaborative that more women will be included in on the job. It has nothing to do with whether somebody is lowering their standards or not. It's a different way of working. And people need to be introspective enough to see that they are blocking out women or other minorities simply because they think their way is the only way of working. Hmm. And so
I'm going to be a pedant for just a second. Women are not a minority.
Yeah.
Said other minorities. So but what you mean, other lower represented in that field people, how they're locking up. So you're saying you've got the person that's in the field that has the problem, or it's just the field that's being overly represented by one type of person. That type of person has a high responsibility to be aware of what is causing that restriction. That's kind of what you're saying, right?
Yes.
And therefore to try to fight it themselves.
And not to be extremely sexist and racist and say, for example, which I have heard at my business, well, women's brains don't work that way.
Ah.
Oh, God. Right. So that kind of.
I know, right?
So that's the introspection you want other people to have, Brian.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think that people have that ability? To be that self-aware?
To self-choose
not,
it?
Not 100% of the time.
Okay. I mean, if you're not aware of it, it's hard to sort of self-create the self-awareness mm-hmm. that leads to being aware of it.
Yeah. Well, I come at this with a really personal story. I come at this with a personal history because my wife and I come from the computer graphics field, and I watched her career. And in the beginning of the career, I would have argued with her all the time about these hidden biases. And as I watched her career over the years and got a front row seat at mm-hmm. the decisions being made around her mm-hmm. And the times where she was discounted, that she was completely right over and over again, I 100% believe that these biases are there now. And for me, it's about looking at myself to see when I'm doing it. And I know I don't get it 100% of the time. So if I, as somebody who's aware of it, can't catch it all the time, certainly somebody who's not even examining themselves is going to miss it all the time.
I think that geek mind that the geeks seem to have in these fields actually can lead themselves to being that skeptical of their own ability. An example of this is I understand that using the term guys is exclusionary. Right. So in a group of people, it's totally appropriate in some ways to say, hey, guys, come on here. But that actually limits people that I'm talking to, right? And definitely makes people feel like an outsider who don't happen to be a guy. And so now when I write that word, it better be that I just wrote a letter where we were all chatting to a group of three men. And so I did say guys, but I checked it, right? I was like, okay, yeah, that's appropriate. And so it's this kind of, you've got to be overly aware of the side effects that you have.
And that's the thing, though. It's uncomfortable. It takes more time. Okay. It takes more mental effort. And it's annoying.
Yeah.
But that's what privilege is. The fact that you have the option to say, that's annoying. I don't know if
annoyed.
I feel like doing that.
Yeah. Right. That's a privilege.
Right.
Don't take advantage of that privilege.
And that weaves into all kinds of other... Mm-hmm. I was just reflecting, as you were talking, Brian, about watching your wife's career, my mom's career. She switched from chemistry, where she experienced a male chauvinist boss, to computer programming, where she just got beat up by it. You know, she kept going from position to position, trying to find an environment that respected her mind and her ability to make decisions and to get credit for what she actually contributed to projects. And she never found it. She never found it in her whole career. So, it's been a problem for a long time. And that just seemed to create a big pall in the room. I don't know why. But it is upsetting. And what you said, Miles, about choosing whether or not to engage in this kind of what can feel like self-flagellating.
But self-correcting.
Self-correcting.
Mm-hmm. Self-awareness. Yeah.
I mean, I understand because there can also be sort of like a political correct.
Makes it harder for me.
Yeah, it makes it harder for me. And then you can get mad at the request to be considered rather than at the discomfort with considering when you didn't have to before.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of the point is the problem exists by people acting this way that mm-hmm. is easier for them to do. Mm-hmm. And so what needs to occur now is the men in tech, speaking directly, they need to think, okay, I have to work harder to make the environment work for everybody. And therefore, the onus is on me to make this a welcoming inclusion place, which means that I've got to figure that out, what I'm doing wrong and what my colleagues are doing wrong, correct them and correct myself. And that is that does take hard work, mm-hmm. but we will all benefit from that because a diverse environment of people will be more productive and better at any task.
And we'll find solutions.
And let's be clear. I, as a man, do not know what it is like to be a woman in tech.
Right.
I don't. I have no intrinsic knowledge in this regard. The only way that I know anything about it is because a woman in tech told me, and then I made the extra step to choose to believe her.
Yeah.
A woman in tech who you respected enough to listen to and regard.
Or, for this matter, many women in tech who all have the same story.
It becomes a data point, right?
Yeah, it does.
Just not dismiss it out of hand and say, like, I'm hearing the story an awful lot. I don't see it myself, but that's the point.
And that story, though it's just a story, also is backed up by all this data about how segregated the field is. Mm-hmm. So that has an extra, you know, scientific methodology behind it. We clearly have a problem here. And look at all these stories, these people that have these experiences. Okay, that's probably the problem. So, yeah.
Well, and this gets us back to your original point, Brian, which is, well, when geeks value fact-based and data-based approaches to work, then to apply that to this problem of why aren't there more of everybody joining us in tech will lead to some good thinking and some good solutions.
Yeah, so I really encourage people to take a look at this article that'll be on geekspeak.org about all this data and research into why women are not staying in the tech field.
Yeah, great. It's Geek Speak on 88.9 KUSP and KUSP.org. I'm Bonnie Premsch, and I'm speaking with Lyle Troxell, Brian Young, and Miles Elam, and lots of stories still to cover. Let's start with an exciting new thing, Miles. We were talking earlier about 3D glass printing requires high temperatures, mm-hmm. and new higher record temperatures for other things as well.
Yes, superconductors. One of the things that has been a limiting factor for superconductors is you have to keep them so cold. General metals that we would expect, you know, copper and like, you would have to bring them down to close to absolute zero to get them to be superconductors. In other words, a superconductor is something that basically is conducting electricity without any appreciable resistance. And then you have the newer ones that are based on ceramics, and these you can cool with liquid nitrogen, which means you, not having to have liquid hydrogen, you know, going up to liquid nitrogen, which is so much easier to deal with, that ends up being opening up the applications, and that's where you see things like CERN using superconductivity for their Large Hadron Collider.
Specifically, superconductivity means that the material does not have resistance. So the electrical flow does not get resisted, which means it doesn't deteriorate, it keeps going. Mm-hmm. And that only occurs in these superconductors, which are almost always at extremely low temperature. Yeah.
And also means that you can have a very small amount of material hold a very large current, mm-hmm. Whereas you would need a very thick piece of copper because you have to worry about that internal resistance.
And then you also have to deal with it heating up because all the current mm-hmm. that goes through with resistance causes heat loss. Right.
So when we're talking about a new record temperature for a superconductor, are we talking about an excitingly warmer temperature
yes.
than we've been able to get to before,
yes.
or we've been able to get to extreme cold?
We are now talking about temperatures that you could see on Earth. Admittedly, Antarctica, and only certain times of the year.
That's really,
sometimes.
Really warm. I mean,
right, but at the same time, still negative 70 degrees C is
that's
really,
not a spring day.
Yeah. No, it right. doesn't exist in nature.
No, it does in Antarctica.
Oh, in Antarctica?
Yeah, it does exist at polar regions.
Okay. And some planets it has it in abundance.
I was going to say, outer space is still nature.
for the future, it's going to be great.
The problem is, and they were doing it using hydrogen sulfide, the rotten egg smell. But they were doing it by putting it to
doing what?
Tremendous pressures. Like so, taking this material and putting it under tremendous pressures,
okay.
the types of pressures that you would see, for example, on Jupiter.
Okay.
So
okay.
The superconductivity worked at this higher temperature only when it was under that pressure.
Right.
Okay.
But that means that that's the thing about superconductivity, though, is that no one's really sure why it works.
Right.
Which is why it's been so hard to find materials.
The leading theory of it is that it's a crystalline structure that's so clean, if you will, that the it's almost like one molecule long. And so that's why electrical flow happens. But that is theoretical in every single way of the word, you know.
That's a lovely guess.
And analyzing it is very difficult when you're at these low temperatures and trying to get measurements because the measuring
equipment
must be...
you can't get in there close enough.
It has to be at that temperature as well. And it's... so anytime that you're raising that temperature... but this is increasing the pressure. They've increased the pressure. Of course, when you add pressure, it increases temperature. And so you have to wait for it to cool off at that pressure.
Yeah. Okay, so this isn't an efficient new thing that's going to hop into every machine.
Right, this is the research lab.
Okay, yeah.
But it's still something they had not seen before because a lot of things like the ceramics were the research lab and then they branched out. So right now they have very small samples because when you're working with pressures that high, you start off with samples that are very, very small.
Right.
It's a very small area. It's easier to get pressures.
Right, okay.
So what will it give us if we actually crack this nut of superconductivity?
Yeah, what's possible?
Well, I can see, for example, if you're at that... if your temperatures that can occur at polar regions, it means, for example, I'm just throwing something out there. You could throw a data center out there that was super efficient with computers that didn't need excess cooling, or rather you had a data center that the cooling that you added to it was very minimal, if at all. Now, of course, that's impractical having something in Antarctica trying to get a power source and generation, but that's a whole other thing.
And in computer chips, you've got a problem now that we're at such a small atomic level that the crosstalk between the different circuits in a chip, is that something that superconductivity would help with?
Yes.
Yeah, when you're talking about negative 70 C, that's... actually, what is the temperature for dry ice?
Not that cold.
It's not 70 degrees, negative 70 degrees.
I don't think so. Well, it might be. I don't know. We can look it up.
You look it up.
Let's move on, I think.
All right, so that's interesting, and we'll see if that leads to anywhere. But basically, scientists are experimenting with pressure and temperature to see if they can make superconducting more.
Dry ice, negative 79 C.
There you go.
Dry ice to cool a semiconductor is much more
possible.
Is much cheaper and much easier than liquid nitrogen.
Wow.
Okay. Huh. So we might be heading that way.
If you can keep it up to pressure.
If you can keep it up to pressure, involving rotten eggs somehow.
Well, that's the question of, is pressure, that's the open question, though, is it the pressure just to make the material, or do you have to keep it under pressure to have it work the way it does?
Sure.
And it may be possible, throwing something out there, you know, area that I have no expertise in, to make something under pressure that still functions normally when brought back to
I read this article differently. You have to keep it at that pressure.
Oh, you do?
I think so.
Okay.
And that would correlate with the idea of it being a large crystal. But,
well, let's move on from this sort of rarefied environment to a more everyday environment.
Mm.
The streets, the mean streets, Lyle.
Okay, let me do a little flashback of a GeekSpeak episode, which I thought was a really cool learning moment. Over the years of looking at GeekSpeak now, I've been starting to think about these moments where we were surprised and interested, or we guessed something and later found out we were completely wrong. That happens all the time in tech. You have to be nimble in your mind and know that that things change. So we had this wonderful story on the show on April 11th, 2009, where we had Sergeant Dean Ackman, who's a neighbor and friend of mine, and he came on because he was leading a task force in San Jose to fight internet fraud. And we're just talking about, like, what kind of data does he do and how does he help people when their machines get hacked and a lot of bank account theft. And, you have to have a police officer actually report the problem to then get the bank to deal with it, right? So he was in that whole internet fraud area and we had a whole show of internet fraud. And while we were chatting with him beforehand of the show or after the show, I can't recall, but I don't think it was on air, he said kind of offhandedly, well, you know, it's like the license plate database that we have about where all the cars are.
And you said,
and it turns out that they had like two or three squad cars at the time that had these cameras mounted on their hoods that everywhere they went, they recorded license plates and information to find out where people were.
Yeah. And they patrolled like mall parking lots, for example.
Yeah, they would patrol areas where large cars were. And the idea was maybe we'll find stolen cars that way. You know, if you had a police officer doing it in a notebook and calling
it
in,
cars are.
It'd be insane.
Yeah.
But if you have an automated system doing it, awesome. So they're building this system. And we thought, well, that seems a little weird because all of a sudden you know where cars are and what about privacy issues? Since then, the San Jose Police Department has actually increased that project so that all squad cars have this.
Mm.
And the database has some rules around it. But it's basically, if you drive in San Jose area, police know where your car is all the time.
Yeah.
That just happens. Except for not all the time, because the police cars are not everywhere.
They're not everywhere. But Miles, you've heard a development on this story that takes
San
things
Jose
a little further.
Is looking, this was covered in the San Jose Mercury News, is looking at using garbage trucks to have these license plate scanners.
All garbage trucks?
That's the idea.
Because why wouldn't you do that?
Because the idea is garbage trucks are going down every street and once a week. And
so you'd be able to get data over time. Like what cars are always here and what cars are not always here.
You would scan the entire city every week.
In a very predictable pattern, repeatable pattern.
So now you would know if John left his car over at Sue's house overnight. Like, it becomes a lot more information about everybody's data, not just the finding the stolen cars. It'll also find stolen cars. Like, stolen cars will be found really fast.
So here's the thing. I'm sure all of us would agree that we want our police force and our laws to be carried out efficiently. We want to be able to catch the criminals. But the geek concern here that I think is when you create a mound of data, even though it's being made for a good purpose, that
it's
mound of data can be used it can be used against you in ways that you don't expect or want.
Right. My concern is with regard to a police car, when there isn't just a list of stolen vehicle license plates and then going and checking against it. A police car also has the computer for looking up any license plate because they have to find out who the person is. They just stopped for a traffic ticket. And it's that connection of that unrelated data, those two unrelated data sets. That's where my concern comes in.
The garbage truck data set and the police car data set?
Well, the garbage trucks are a whole other one because that one is a live, hey, we've seen all these. The question is, how is it implemented? Are they giving out a list of all of those ID, those license plates of stolen cars and putting it to the truck for the truck to find, or are they sending back every single license plate, in which case, how are we securing that data is not being used for tracking purposes?
Okay, well, and given that the garbage trucks are not city trucks, they're private contractors serving the city, how much are we actually obliging contractors to do government work?
Right. Well, okay.
And
so
should this be government work?
Let's talk about that implementation. You're right, Miles. If someone lost a car and then within the 1 week, all the garbage trucks are looking for that car, and if it's in the city on garbage day, then the car's found. That, to me, seems like what most people read in the story. Mm-hmm. Perfect. What a great implementation. But the actual details of that is that's the wrong way to implement it from a technical perspective. A technical perspective is you collect all license plate information, all locations, all the time. Then, when a car is stolen, you know where it was last seen, right? You don't have to wait to then find it. But that means that you're collecting data so that you can fight future crimes. And that is, there is a boundary there that's problematic.
Now we're getting to Philip K. Dick territory.
But yeah, exactly. It does feel that way. Mm-hmm. And the side effect that is concerning to the geeks that knows that the database is there is that what if somebody that has access to that database wants to use it for other means? And there's a lot of other means you could use it for. I mean,
we're seeing hackers hack into everything, including the anti-hacking companies.
The amount of data collected.
We've shown how hard it is to secure any data.
Yeah.
And having this data available is just a huge target for anybody who wants to misuse it.
Yeah.
So
regulation.
Regulation.
The summary of this is regulation. We have to have the populace aware.
Well, accountability. It's not so much regulation because the regulations, to a large extent, already exist.
Okay.
I guess my concern is, and this comes from someone who's a person of color, if I can't really trust that, for example, a person of color won't get accosted by the police and then have that police officer indicted, what's my comfort level is eroded that if someone is compromising the data in a way that shouldn't be used, that the person who did this will be held accountable.
Yeah. So when you're thinking of accountable, what does that look like? And what does it look like when contractors to the city are recording license plate?
Well, the contractors don't probably have access to the data. They better not. But Miles is talking more about.
But if something goes awry, who does the person who is wronged?
Right. So if an officer at the court decides to find out if his wife is cheating on anybody and then finds out that there's a car parked outside on Wednesday mornings all the time that he doesn't recognize and he, you know, then goes accost that person, that's a complete, like, that he shouldn't be able to do that at all.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens if he does? And the accountability aspect is the thing you're asking about. It's common for police forces to not subjugate their own employees when they do something wrong, to support each other.
That's the culture.
You can't make a perfect system, but there has to be some accountability when the rules are broken. Because there are rules with regard to data retention and stuff like that with regard to the police. I mean, they've got tons of them. We talked about it the last time we had the show.
There has to be court oversight, or there has to be a watchdog group that
there
can
have
some
visibility to
it. There
has to be police oversight over the police. There actually has to be cops to say, hey, you just did something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to now be put on trial.
Well, it's one thing for us to talk amongst ourselves about this, but we'd love to hear from you too. And if you'd like to communicate with the show, one way you can reach GeekSpeak is via Twitter or Facebook. We are KUSP Geeks, all one word. And if you have questions or comments for us, send us a tweet. We'll collect them up and respond next week. It's GeekSpeak here on KUSP, the term GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission, and GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, live online at KUSP.org. I want to remind you again that you can find out more about this or any episode of GeekSpeak. You can just go to geekspeak.org. We'll have links to all the stories we talked about today, and you can use that as fodder to communicate with us and further the discussion. You can also email us at geeks@geekspeak.org. Our theme song is by Michael Newman. You're hearing it now, of Pet Star Music. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch with Miles Elam, Lyle Troxell, and Brian Young. GeekSpeak is produced by Lyle Troxell. Thanks to our intern, Chandler, our Canadian correspondent, Greg Merkley, and thank you for being here for this August 22nd, 2015 episode of GeekSpeak.